Okay, here we go. Hello. Thank you for showing up if you've shown up. Thank you for listening if you're listening later. This is Reclaiming the Divine Feminine. And tonight we're definitely having a rather large PowerPoint. So if you're listening to the recording, you might like to print off the PowerPoint. If you go take it to your printer, you can get it to print 6 of the images on one page. Just look for the settings on your printer. So then you can have them to hand if you want to look at the pretty pictures. The pictures are mostly to distract you from the fact that of me sitting here staring at you and yakking, but to just give you visual ideas. And they're also prompts for me to remember what I'm trying to tell you about. So we'll have a screen share in a minute or two. But I'll try to talk as if the PowerPoint isn't there as much as possible, so that you can also listen to this as an MP3 if you want to do that. So if you're sitting comfortably, I will share the screen and we will begin. So Reclaiming the Divine Feminine, we've got 3 beautiful images on the PowerPoint, having just said that we weren't going to refer to it, which are more unusual images of the feminine. We've got a Madonna and child on the left, but she's Japanese. We've got an icon of a woman from the Judeo-Christian tradition. That's from a little church in Crete. And we've got a black angel. Now, one of the things that we're going to be talking a lot about is the world, the culture. And I'm actually going to call it mother culture, because our culture is what nurtures us and builds our ego, builds our personas. It's the vessel from which we grow up. And our mother culture is pretty much everything at the moment that the divine feminine is not. So to see a black angel is really unusual. And when things hit you as being really unusual about the feminine, that's usually a bit of a wake-up call. And we are in a big wake-up call time at the moment. So what are we going to be talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about gods and goddesses. We're going to be talking about saving the planet. We're going to talk about perennial truths and ancient history, responsibility. We're going to talk about Mother Earth. We're going to talk about yin and yang. We're going to talk about rebalancing, ecology, witches, culture, fairies, and ultimately peace. So as you can see, there's a heck of a lot to get through on this course. And one of the biggest things that we know that we have to deal with at the moment is helping our planet, because our planet has been really quite... Well, it's a bit like the planet's got psoriasis, and psoriasis is humanity. The planet right down in her heart is absolutely fine, and she can only has to sneeze to get rid of us and take about 1 million years to get herself back to balance again. And trust me, she will do it if she needs to, because the divine feminine, as reflected in Mother Nature, is not nice. The divine feminine is very strong, very powerful, and it doesn't play nice. And one of the things that we need to learn as humanity is that if we want the divine feminine to play at all nice with us, we've got to play nice with her. And we really haven't been doing that. And the problem I think we've got with climate change, ecology, helping the planet and all that is, yes, some of us are very enthusiastic and some of us are very angry. But ecology itself isn't inspirational. And we humans nowadays seek inspiration all the time. We want to be entertained and we want to be excited by things. And that's actually the sacred masculine, excitement and expansion. But it's fine to play that game because that's what we're used to. So we do need to take another look at what is happening with the planet and how we can help in a way that does at least make our juices flow in some kind of way. So it's not feeling negative, because stopping pollution, sorting out the trash, reducing our carbon imprint, cutting down all the fluorocarbons, you know, getting a hybrid car, searching for products without plastic, living a simple life, downsizing, eating seasonally, eating locally sourced products. It's not easy. And it's not inspiring, and it comes across as very hard work. And what we need, I think, and what I hope I'm going to inspire you with this, is a new old vision. And it's actually a return to a very old vision. And how do we know that the secret's old? Well, we really know for the simple reason that we didn't have a problem and the planet didn't have a problem before humanity became Homo sapiens. In the human lineage, up until Homo sapiens, we lived in peace and harmony with the planet and all the creatures on it. Yes, the occasional tiger came and took one of us, but it really didn't happen very often. And we didn't lay waste to anything. We lived in accordance to the laws of nature and to the laws of the sacred masculine and the divine feminine. We didn't try and control things. Until we became Homo sapiens, we belonged to the world, as all the other creatures do. Until we became Homo sapiens, we evolved naturally, like all the other creatures have and do. Until we became Homo sapiens, we did not till or harvest the land or try to control it. Until we became Homo sapiens, we didn't put up fences. Until we became Homo sapiens, we didn't try to eliminate threats. And this is one of the problems that humanity has brought to the planet, in that we're not just content with making sure that the cabbage stem boll weevil wasn't on our land. We've had to exterminate the cabbage stem boll weevil from all lands. So we have gone on a march of extermination of everything that doesn't feed us. And that includes everything that feeds on the food that feeds us, everything that grows in the ground that doesn't feed us, and everything that may be any kind of opposition to what we want. Until we became Homo sapiens, we never believed that we were God's final creation. We never believed that we were what all of this is about. We never believed that we were the only begotten of God, because to everything before Homo sapiens, creation itself was the only begotten of the gods, or God, whichever you want to do. Usually in our earlier days we had gods. We sometimes had the overarching aspect, but it was mostly gods. And religion as we know it today supports the idea that Homo sapiens is the most important thing there is, and everything else comes beneath it. And yes, the Bible is at fault in that, because it says that God told us that we would have dominion over the earth. Now, the word dominion is a complex one. We do have dominion. We are, as far as we know, the only species so far that's conscious of being conscious. And we have dominion, we have power over everything, and we're showing it. But how we use that power is what's important. And the evidence of what we truly believe nowadays is on slide number 5, which is showing the geological timeline of the Earth. And we all know that humanity turned up a couple of minutes before midnight, if you put the world clock on 24 hours. But that diagram there has exactly what we have come to believe and what our mother culture is now. At the bottom, there's a little line that says, "Read the full briefing, a man-made world." We do not live in a man-made world. The man-made world is the destructive world. The divine feminine and the sacred masculine are the actual world, and every other creature but us honours that. We humans believe that nothing before us actually mattered. Religion teaches us, and I'm an ordained minister, as you know, so I have a lot of time for a lot of religion, but I haven't got a lot of time for the religion that actually says that the whole of creation was just a waiting cradle for man or humanity. We just came in and we are reorganizing it to suit us, to make our lives as easy, and the divine feminine does not support that. And I'm going to go straight for the hilt here. We've got lots of campaigns in the world about how we can make the world better, one of which is vegetarianism and veganism. And yes, I get that. But in fact, vegetarianism and veganism are really driving the man-made problems just as much as anything to do with cattle. Because you cannot in the United Kingdom, you can in California, we've got a couple of people from California on this, you can eat as a vegan sustainably in California. So go do it. Terrific. In the United Kingdom, you can't. Well, you could, but you'd be on cabbage and apples for the whole of the winter, and that would be it. So in fact, Some of our lifestyle choices, which we think are really ecological, are battering the planet. They're bringing in blueberries from Chile, quinoa from Bolivia. We know about palm oil. We know about the destruction of the rainforest. And so much of our food that fits our ecological arrogance, if you like, is coming from the other side of the planet. And in many of the countries, we're not going to do this, I know that, but where we live on Dartmoor, if you're a carnivore, if you hunt, you can live sustainably throughout the winter. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm just pointing out that that is the only way that where I live, I can live sustainably, because I couldn't do it where I live as a vegan. So on this course, we're going to be working with myth. And there's a couple of definitions here of what myth is thought to be nowadays. And myth is summed up as a traditional story, especially one concerning the early history of a people or explaining a natural or social phenomenon and typically involving supernatural beings or events. And the other definition is a widely held but false belief or idea, such as the belief that evening primrose oil helps to cure eczema. Well, some people would say that evening primrose oil does help to cure eczema. Some people wouldn't. But that is not what the original meaning of myth is. A myth is a perennial truth. It's a magical story that reveals a perennial truth. Lord of the Rings is a perfect myth because it's got the stories of nations either working together or not working together for a common good. It's got magical aspects to it, and it's got good versus evil. All ultimate myths are about how to be a good person, how to live a good and honourable life. And because a myth is a greater truth, it never spares you from the fact that the journey involves sacrifice, grief, and failure, as well as bravery, gain, and triumph. And the feminine is the part of us. This isn't about men and women. It's about the yin and yang within us. The yin is the part of us that experience sorrow and failure and sacrifice. And in this modern world, we're really not very happy with that. But actually, I'm afraid we have to embrace it. We're going to be doing a lot of quotations and a lot of research with Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell was an amazing mythologist in America, and he was the inspiration behind Star Wars. He worked with George Lucas. Star Wars is another modern myth and a very important one. And to quote Joseph, half the people in the world think that the metaphors of their religious traditions, for example, are facts. The metaphors are not facts, they're metaphors. They're greater truths. Myth offers a greater truth than anything in the realm of mere logic. Myth is much more important and true than history. History is just journalism, and you know how reliable that is. And history is also written by the winners, and right now, the Divine Feminine is not the winner. We need to work out how we can help her be the winner. So let's check in on ancient religion as perennial truth. And I just want to show you a couple of pictures here that show that it comes out no matter what. No matter what we want to do, the truth is going to come up. It's going to come through. I'm turning to Christianity now because that's like my line of expertise, and two amazing pictures here. The feminine yin energy is about darkness, death, and the womb. In all the ancient cultures, and in the next session we're going to be talking about the ancient goddesses and the ancient cultures, the goddess was the one that resurrected the dead. Without going into the cave, into the darkness, into death, into despair, if you like, you would not have rebirth. So the legend was always, and we don't know absolutely for sure, but Joseph Campbell believes it, and several other anthropologists I've talked to say that in the ancient days in the hunter-gathering societies, before a hunt, the hunters would go down into a cave, into the darkness. They would take light with them if they could, and they would commune with the Great Mother, They would draw images of the beasts that they wanted to hunt, and they would ask her permission to hunt them. They would ask for her to bring them the kill. And then they would come out, and then they would do the hunt. And when they had done the hunt, they would honour the creature, use everything, and give thanks, and then perhaps go back down and do another drawing in honour of the creature. So the feminine is the tomb, it's the cave, it's the womb. The masculine in all of us, the yang energy, is light, birth, and regrowth. The masculine is the resurrected one. So we are both. All of us are both. There's no doubt about that. And in the story of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all have the story of Jesus is put in a tomb in a cave belonging to Joseph of Arimathea. And the women anoint his body as it goes into the cave, and they wait. And on the morning of the resurrection, it's been the Sabbath, so they will have had to have gone home at that point. Mary Magdalene goes to the cave when it is still dark. And this is a perennial truth, bleeding through, because the resurrection may never have happened without those women. Without that divine feminine. Now, again, this is a myth. We don't know if any of this actually happened, but the myth comes through. And without that darkness that's in the feminine, without that strength, without that counterbalance, we really, really, really aren't going to thrive. And to quote Uncle Joseph again, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. We don't want to go into that cave. We really, really don't. Entering the darkness is exactly the opposite of everything that our mother culture today teaches. We rationalize everything since the time of the Enlightenment, which was when rational thought and science came in. We have rationalized everything. We've thrown out the myths and we leave no room for doubt. And the opposite of faith is certainty. We seek certainty. And the more certain we are, the less faith we can have. And we need faith to work with the divine feminine. Now, I know that some of this is going to be quite difficult to hear for the simple reason that the world we live in and our mother culture nurtures us and we are trained not to see it. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. The Enlightenment, however, was really anything but. It was necessary. It brought us some amazing stuff. But it took away all our understanding of the value of not knowing. Not having to trust. Because we don't have to trust. We can go down to the supermarket and get some more food with our credit card. We don't have to trust anymore. So we're looking at yin and yang, and we're looking at the tree of life. And these two are symbols of exactly the same thing, which sounds ridiculous, but they actually are. The yin-yang symbol has got the sacred masculine, if you like, as white, and the sacred feminine as dark, because that's how these two aspects of us work. And in each one is a spot of the other. So in the light, there is a spot of the darkness, and in the dark, there is a spot of the light. And that's to stop a fundamental overbalance. Because if you have a fundamental overbalance, you can't thrive. If you're all action and you've got no rest, eventually you're going to blow yourself out. So overaction is always corrected in nature, as is underaction. A heart disease, for example, is contraction. So it's a disease of a denial of the divine feminine. And it's generally, a lot more women are getting it since we went out into the corporate world, but as a general rule, it's still thought to be a disease of the masculine. And heart disease is a contraction, which then explodes because the contraction, the limitation, becomes far too powerful and there's a bang like a volcano. On the other side, the expansion in illness is cancer. Cancer is a disease that just never stops growing. it won't stop growing, and it will not do anything unless we stop it with chemotherapy or surgery, and then quite frequently it comes back. And both chemotherapy and surgery are paralyzing agents for this continual growth. And if a cancer isn't stopped, then the ultimate expansion ends in absolute full stop with death. So hopefully you can see that you have to have the balance of the opposite. You have to have the masculine in the feminine, you have to have the feminine in the masculine. And on the tree of life, and that's on slide number 10 with the yin and yang symbol, you can see that there are three vertical columns. There's also three horizontal columns. And we're going to keep coming back to this again and again, this idea of three, of Trinity, which is the source, the sacred feminine, and the sacred masculine. You've got to have those three working together. And everything works much better in a cycle of three. And on the tree of life, I'm going to be as simple as I can about the tree of life tonight, because this isn't explicitly a course on Kabbalah, though it is my way of explaining things. So you will see a few trees in here and there. The central column is known as consciousness. And it pulls together the left-hand column, which is receptive, feminine, and the right-hand column, which is active, masculine. And unless we pull those together in the centre, either with the three cross lines or with the circle in the centre, which is known as Tiferet, the place of truth and beauty, we're going to swing ourselves out of balance. And we're all always a little bit out of balance. Do not expect yourself to get into total balance within about 5 minutes, because we have a lot of mother culture that we really have to work with. So a bit about what the tree of life is. The Kabbalistic tree of life is simply a diagram of humanity's relationship with the divine, the universe, and ourselves. The top circle is the divine. The bottom circle is our physical body. And in between those, we've got our true self, our the plexus chakra, if you like, in the middle. We've got our ego, which would be our gonadic or sacral chakra below there. And above there, we've got our throat and third eye chakras, which are our inner knowledge through which we perceive spirit. So you can see it works very similarly to the chakra system. You can also put the Ten Commandments on the tree of life, the Christian sacraments on the tree of life, because it's actually a diagram of how the universe works. It was formulated purely through simple observation over millennia. So it's a kind of system of checks and balances, always telling us to pull back to the middle and see how far we are over to one side or the other. It teaches also that if we work from the top, if we, from our true self, if we look up to the divine and listen, then life will work for us in a flow. But if we look down into the ego, which also includes our culture and what society says we should do, then we are trying to control our life, which means we are subject to law. And that's the law of the land, that's the law of nature. If we look up, we have grace. If we look down, we have law. And this is image number 12, and I would like to look at that if you've got your PowerPoints printed off, because I think the best way to explain the tree of life is with a cup of tea. There was a wonderful series of memes about the time of Me Too about equating rape with a cup of tea. Ask somebody if they want a cup of tea, and if they say no, don't make them a cup of tea. If somebody says they want a cup of tea, and then when you've made the cup of tea, they don't want the cup of tea, don't make them drink the cup of tea. And it goes on like that. So I just thought it was a wonderful analogy to use with the tree of life. So if you start at the top, the Hebrew word keter means crown. And it's a hollow crown through which we receive inspiration from the higher worlds, from the divine, from spirit. So at that level, right at the very top, we have an idea. And then in this particular case, I'd like a hot drink. Then you move from that to the sephira to the right, which is known Chokmah, which is inspiration or wisdom. And that's an active circle or sephira. So you get the idea, you've got to do something about it, which means if you want a hot drink, put the kettle on. It's that simple. Now, you don't have to do anything else. In the ancient days, you did have to do something else. You had to take the kettle off the fire because otherwise the kettle would burn dry and possibly explode. So that's why you have the checks and balances of the vertical path over to the Bina, which is the place of understanding, and the birthplace of the divine feminine, the place of understanding and strength. You have to turn the kettle off. And then again, you don't have to do anything else. And that's because the next stage goes through the place called Da'at, which is a non-sephira. It's a kind of black hole. This is where we have to seriously use our free will and our choice to make anything happen. So you can put the kettle on and the kettle will just stop and you can forget about it and not make a cup of tea. The black hole part is where you have to say, do I actually want to have this cup of tea? Do I want a cup of coffee? Do I want a herbal tea? Do I want a hot water? Do I want to make my own tea? What kind of tea do I want? And you've actually got to commit to something, which is the making of the tea. And if you commit to something, the sephira next one is hesed, which is loving kindness and expansion again. So you make and you pour the tea. Another active thing. So that's the divine masculine. Then you switch across to the feminine, the left-hand side again, and you sit down and you drink your tea. Then you go to the centre, which is the place known as Tiferet, the place of the perennial truth, the whole truth, the beautiful truth, and you have the whole tea experience. You're sitting down, you've got your cup of tea which you made, and it is now going down into your body. What was first thought of in your thoughts, in spirit, is now touching your body. It's going into a lower world. Then we move from there to the active bit again, where your body takes over and it starts digesting and spreading the nutrients or not in your tea around your body. Then the checks and balances go along the left-hand side, which is the body absorbs and processes the tea and rejects the bits it doesn't want. And sends them into the bladder or the bowels or whatever and gets rid of them. Then you come down to yesod, which is our ego, which is our persona, how we present ourselves. And having had your cup of tea, you feel better. And then from there, the energy of the tea goes down to malkut, which is your physical body, the actual reality. You've got more energy, you probably need to pee, and you're ready to move on to the next thing. So is that making some kind of sense to you, those of you who are watching? Okay, so the tea tree, it is. Good. Let's move on. Now, let's go back to Trinity. The idea of Trinity is absolutely everywhere. It isn't just a Christian concept. It was pre-Christian. We know that the Semites had it, the Hebrews had it, the Babylonians had it. And it's the law of three, which is that you need three to make a dance, a circle. If you've just got two, you've got two opposing forces. If you've got a third one, you've got a mitigating or empowering aspect. And we can see this in mediation. A couple who are trying to cancel each other are probably just going to end up having arguments. They need a third person there to sort of hold the balance. For the feminine, because we saw that making of the tea diagram, you can see that the flow of energy from the divine, as documented by the Tree of Life, is both receptive and active. Even though the right-hand column is active, the flow from the divine at the top has to be received in that circle and then passed on. So every aspect of both masculine and feminine has to have that yin-yang aspect of the other in it. Everything that receives must be able to pass on, and everything that gives must be able to receive. And our biggest problem with the divine feminine is we're not good at receiving. Very much not good at receiving. So the best known trinity of the feminine is the idea of the maiden, the mother, and the crone. The maiden is youth, the mother is maturity, and the crone is old age. Nowadays, we support the maiden, we love beauty, we go for glamour, we're fine with the mother, we're great with the mother, and we have replaced the crone with the internet. We really don't have an awful lot of time for the wise woman. In the interest of balance, I've also put up there the masculine, which would be the father, the youth, and the sage. So whether we're male or female, we still work with this trinity of youth, middle age and old age. And these are really important because if we don't work with these aspects of the three, we won't be complete. The mother is the one that holds the energy, Mother Nature and the Mother Goddess. The others are really important, but it's the mother that is really the one that we'll be focusing on here. Now, let's have a look at the attributes of the active masculine and the receptive feminine in all of us. And these are all quite good, clear attributes. They're on slide number 15 if you want to look at it. And I will read them out because I'm sure you'll be able to think more of them, but hopefully you'll know which ones you're comfortable with. So let's start with the ones that we love, which is the right-hand column, because it's so much more popular than the left-hand column. It's so much more exciting and interesting than the left-hand column. And it's got freedom and inspiration, creativity and force and enthusiasm and expansion and growth and yes and please and action and mercy and generosity and life and day and light and flow and wakefulness and war and brightness and growth and heat and positivity. Whereas the balance we need to hold all those steady without going crazy are boundaries, understanding, strength, form, discernment, discipline, contraction, no, thank you, passivity, contemplativeness, if that's even a word, contemplation, that's right, receptiveness, thought, death, night, darkness, sleep, martial arts, because that's using the energy of your enemy to overcome them, structure, law, or law, depends on how you want to spell it, L-O-R-E or L-A-W, coldness and negativity. So I'm sure you can see that generally the right-hand column is far more interesting. That's the one our mother culture has trained us to believe in. Now let's look at the negatives, the bad aspects, because each of these aspects of the tree of life can be either good or bad according to how we use them. The active column, when it goes negative, is revolution. Of course, that can be positive too, but it usually leads to death. Rebellion, anarchy, violence, gratification, greed, fire. Fire can be very good. Addiction, consumerism, marketing, binging, abuse, taking, adulation, glamour, adultery, and cancer. And we have a world filled with all of that right now. The left hand, and this is the toxic yin that supports the toxic yang. The rules, well, rules can be good or bad. Law can be good or bad. Control, paralysis, pain, guilt, flood, blame, passive aggression, neglect, refusal, denial, judgment, contempt, executions, incarcerations, and heart disease. And we've got a lot of those as well right now. Because if we won't stand on the central column and try and balance these things out, they will go into imbalance. So the darkness contains the light, and the light contains the darkness. And how utterly screwed up we've got on this, pardon my French, is shown by this New Age diagram on page number 17. Which shows the yin-yang symbol without understanding a word of it. Because the light has got the sun in it and the dark has got the moon in it. No, the dark has the moon and the sun has the light. Otherwise, we really aren't understanding. And that is a beautiful symbol of how even in holistic health, where our mother culture has taught us that the only valid sight is the light. The only valid teaching is expansion. The only valid thing is the masculine. And humanity is utterly dedicated to the light. This is what our culture, our modern culture of Homo sapiens teaches us. And this is what is known as a Luciferic truth. Lucifer was the angel, the archangel. The legend tells, and it's purely a legend, it's not in the Bible or anything like that, but it's a very powerful legend and it is a myth. A Luciferic truth is where somebody would rather leave heaven in order to rule in hell. Lucifer would not serve the divine. He would not serve humanity. Mind you, again, this story does put humanity as being the most important thing. So even the Lucific truth has a Lucific truth within it. But the idea is that Lucifer is beautiful. Lucifer means the light bearer. Evil cannot succeed unless it presents itself to us as virtuous and glamorous and beautiful. We can spot darkness if it comes in ugly form. We're afraid of ugliness. We look at something ugly and we go, oh, that's not right. We look at something beautiful and we think, oh, that's nice. We think that more is better. We don't know how to stop. And we have to keep peddling. Basically, how humanity's been living since the dawn of agriculture, to be honest. It sounds like I'm blaming agriculture. I'm not. But it has been the driving force behind nearly all of this, our possession of the earth. Basically, what happened is when we started agriculture, we started planting our crops and controlling our fields and stopping the pests. And it was wonderful. We had enough food to store all the time. We could have more leisure. We had more relaxation. We could expand. And we could get bigger and bigger and get more and more people on the planet. Herders don't do that. The hunter-gatherers and the herding nations control their population. But people who live in agriculture don't, because apart from anything else, they want the workers on the land. So basically, our step into agriculture was a bit like the early flight avatars. Aviators, not avatars, but they turned out to be avatars. With a machine that flapped like a bird, and they pedaled it off a cliff. And to start with, as they went down, they were flying. They were doing great. It was really exciting. And if they just pedaled harder, they'd level out any second now. But that's exactly what humanity is doing right now. We are just in free fall, in a machine that doesn't fly, pedaling harder. Fortunately for us, our pedals have a reverse, but we have to hit the reverse. So now let's talk a little bit about evil, because this is the basis for where we humans get into a bit of a mess. There are three levels of evil. This is very clear in the prophets. It's also very clear in St. Paul, who's not a very popular teacher in the modern world because of the cultural attitudes towards women in his day. And we tend to still project onto him the same cultural attitudes, and we keep telling him he's wrong, whereas it was like that when he was, and it wasn't like that when we were. But Paul was also a very great mystic, and he explained these three levels of evil just as well as the prophets did. The first level is the world, and that is the system. It's neither good nor bad. It can be either. It's how we live. It's our culture. It's our mother culture. The systems of the world are how we built our civilization. They include the railways, the governments. They include Extinction Rebellion is part of the world now. Everything in the world that becomes a system, a group, a culture is the world. And when we're in it, it benefits us. So it is invisible to us. Unless we wake up and become fully conscious, the world and its evils is invisible because it serves us. There's no possible way that you can tell a right-wing Republican in America, who's a supporter of Donald Trump. If you're listening to this after the American election, well, who knows what's going to happen. But if you're listening before the election, you'll know there's no way you could change the mind of a Trumpist, because they're living in the world that fits them. They can't see that there's any other world that's valid. It's the same with what is known as the liberal elite in America. Sorry, America, if I'm being rude to you. We've got exactly the same here with Brexit in the United Kingdom, I promise you. The liberal elite also can't see outside their pockets. The liberal elite will do more good, more charity, more kindness, but they still can't see behind outside their pockets. They'll be allies for Black Lives Matter. And that's good. But they don't actually quite get down and dirty in the aspect. Now, of course, hopefully you're not like either of those and you can see the world for what it is. But the second level is the flesh. And that is the one that all the fundamentalists focus on, which is a complete and utter waste of time. Because the flesh only becomes a sin because of the world. The flesh, whatever we call the sins of the flesh, are judged by the culture that we live in. So basically, St. Paul uses flesh as a negative term for anything that's purely individual, passing, partial, or untrustworthy. He's not referring to the body. He's not talking about sex or anything like that. That's included in it. But the way the world is going to how you're going to judge sins of the flesh. And the two major sins, the hotspots of the sins of the flesh in the modern world are abortion and LGBTQ rights. The people who live in the right-wing world cannot see anyone who's gay or anyone who has an abortion as being anything other than wrong. The people who live in the liberal world cannot see anyone who doesn't support LGBTQ rights or selective abortion is wrong. And for us, it's very easy because if we're on this course, we're almost certainly liberal. So we're going to, well, of course, abortion is okay in certain circumstances. Of course, LGBTQ is fine. Because we live in that culture, we live in that world, and that is our truth. But the truth of the matter is also that the ones who don't live in that culture cannot see it the way we do. And we cannot see it the way they do. So we judge them. The we always judges the other culture as being wrong through the sins of their flesh. What they do as individuals. And the final level of evil, and St. Paul sums it up beautifully in Ephesians, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Now, principalities and powers are the names of some of the archangels. And these are, he's referring to fallen archangels, so Lucific, as in the only way that evil can succeed in the world is when we make the world virtuous. We make the system virtuous. We say, for example, lock down the whole country is good because it's saving humanity. Lock down the whole country is causing huge mental health issues. And this is a big, big issue, the whole COVID-19 thing. And we'll be talking about it a little bit more as we go on. But to say that something that the culture requires right now is good is a form of evil because it's presenting it as the only option. And it's presenting it that we are the virtuous ones imposing these rules on you. Or we are the virtuous ones. Whatever something says we are the virtuous ones, then we are going to realise that there is something going very, very wrong at some level. Now I'm going to do some fairly light-hearted stuff to show you some of this. And I'm going to show you Meg Ryan. The lovely Meg Ryan is on slide number 20. And here are the three levels. The world loves Meg Ryan. The world loved her in Sleepless in Seattle. She was the archetypal of the youth, and she was beautiful, and she played this lovely, ditzy, gorgeous girl. So that's what the world expects from Meg Ryan. Meg Ryan grew up. Now, picture in the middle, Meg Ryan's had a little bit of Botox there, you can tell by the forehead. And at this point in her career, Meg Ryan wanted to mature and expand out. She wanted to do movies like The Cut, which she made, a Jane Campion movie in 2003. And the opposition that the world gave to Meg Ryan for making a movie like that, which was dark and dirty and controversial, was extraordinary. I saw an interview with Michael Parkinson, which was generally known as a train wreck, and people blamed Meg for the train wreck. But what Michael Parkinson, representing the world, did, Michael Parkinson, if you're not from the UK, was a talk show host, a very famous one in the United Kingdom, and he did the prime talk show for decades, I think. He had Meg on when she was trying to promote the cut, and all he said to her is, why can't you go back to being the sweet, beautiful girl we loved? Why can't you do more lovely movies? Why do you have to step out? Why do you have to do this horrible stuff? And what he was actually saying to her is, why do you have to grow up? And Meg Ryan, as far as I know, has never done another movie like that. I don't suppose Michael Parkinson changed her mind, but I'm sure an awful lot of stuff did. And if you look at the picture on the right, you see Meg Ryan in full facelift mode. Meg Ryan now is in her 60s. Meg Ryan doesn't look like that. But Meg Ryan's facelift looks like that. And of course, she's got a load of flack for the facelift because she doesn't look like Meg Ryan anymore. But can you see, it's a silly example, but it's the world, the flesh. The flesh did a little bit of Botox to cope with the world. And the devil was when, I'm going to say this, Meg Ryan was fooled into thinking that having a full facelift would help her. And that's how the world today is. And in the interest of balance, here we have Russell Crowe on slide number 21. Russell Crowe's actually got it right. To start with, Russell Crowe, the youth, gorgeous, in a kind of teenage boy, oops, getting embarrassing, move swiftly on, Maggie kind of way. Russell Crowe in the middle at about 40, 41, as the gladiator, the warrior, whoa. Excuse me, moving on. Russell Crowe on the right doesn't give a crap. Russell Crowe on the right has grown older, put on the weight, got all the wrinkles, doesn't give a damn. If he needs to for a role, he'll slim down because he's got the discipline to do it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is how you actually adopt the divine feminine. Russell Crowe, for all his He-Man antics, understands that the crone, the old person, is just as valid. And what's more, the crone doesn't give a crap. And finally, the goddess herself, which is Judi Dench. You'll probably all know Judi Dench. Look at those three pictures. Every single one of them is magnificent. She hasn't had a tad of work done. And yet she's totally respected. So we can do it. Ladies and gentlemen, there is hope. We can allow ourselves to become the wise ones, to become the epitome of the divine feminine, which is youth, mother, father, and crone. We will allow ourselves to be the elder. That's what we need in the modern world. And here's one more example. The flesh, the world, and the devil. And this one may push your buttons a little bit. The world in the centre is this idea that war is necessary and we do our duty and we go off and we march and we fight for our women, and that's what we do. On the left-hand side is the flesh, which is the actual reality of war, which is the possibility you're going to murder somebody face down and shoot them in the back. War is nasty and individuals have to do terrible things because the culture has told us we go to war. But the devil is on the right-hand side. And you won't like that, me saying that, because she's beautiful, she's dynamic, she's powerful, she's amazing. But to make a goddess go out to kill people and to say that is good is how twisted we've become. I love that picture of Wonder Woman. It makes my heart sing. I have to admit, I think it's absolutely gorgeous. But it's an absolute example of where we are now. We are now in a world where women, the mothers, the ones who give birth to the children, are willing to go into the front line to kill other people's children because our mother culture tells us that is right. And we believe it. And you may well believe it yourself, but just be aware that you're believing something that encourages the feminine, the protector of life, the giver of life, to kill. Obviously, it's the masculine aspect of the women who's going out to war, but it's not a virtue. Going to war and having to kill people is a sorrow to be avoided as much as possible. We should not be telling our soldiers they are heroes. The Japanese, actually, are the people who got this right at the end of the Second World War. They have what is known as the honourable soldier, because they realised that soldiers were coming back not knowing how to live, because they'd been out there in control, destroying. And they didn't know how to live in an everyday culture. So they had what was known as the honourable soldier ritual, where the soldier was sat down by family and other people who had also been soldiers, and they were thanked for everything they had to do, for all the sorrow they had to do, for all the killings they had to do, because they were required to do it. And then they are officially and formally, in a ritual, released from being a soldier and told to go back into the world and live in a different fashion. And this ritual is incredibly powerful. And I gather, I can't prove this, but I gather from the research I have done with a friend called Hiromi in Japan, that there's much less PTSD following battle in Japan, because the soldiers are honourably released and told that that aspect of them is no longer required. So how did we get here? Let's quote Joseph Campbell. In the older view, the goddess universe was alive, herself organically, the earth, the horizon, and the heavens. In the ancient traditions, the goddess was the earth, the horizon, and the heavens. And in fact, the whole of creation was within her uterus being born. Now the goddess is dead and the universe is not an organism, but a building with gods at rest in it in luxury, not as personifications of the energies in their manners of operation, but as luxury tenants requiring servants. And for gods, read people in power. And man, accordingly, is not as a child born to flower in the knowledge of his own eternal portion, but as a robot fashioned to serve. So we got here by believing that humanity is exempt from universal law. The universal law on our planet is that everything on the planet belongs to the world. We believe that we are exempt. And oddly, there are stories in the Bible which eventually ended up being edited by the winners, but had included some of the stories from what we call the losers, the herding people who became overrun by the agricultural people. There are still a few stories in the Bible that we're going to go back to have a look at, to say that the perennial tradition will work its way through. And it does in the story of Cain and Abel, because nobody in our modern world understands that, especially not the ecologists. Because we're being taught, and there's value in it, that we should go vegetarian or vegan. Cain brought the fruit of the ground as an offering to the Lord. Cain was agriculture. He grew crops. Abel bought the firstborn of his flock and the fat thereof. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but Cain and his offering he had no respect for. And Cain killed Abel. And that is the story of humanity. The agriculturists, the people with the fences, the people who needed to destroy the rivals who were taking up their land, were the ones who went to war against the hunters, the gatherers, and the herders. And that's not a truth that we like to believe in, but that's how it was. So our task, and I hope I haven't made you feel too uncomfortable tonight, but in a way, a little bit of discomfort is a good thing, because it means that you're thinking. And I'm not here to tell you what to believe, and you're not here to believe everything I tell you, but I am here to try and make you reconsider. Metanoia is the word in the New Testament. We get it translated as repent, but it means think anew. Take another look. So the task of reclaiming the divine feminine begins by being willing to receive what the divine has to give instead of trying to control the situation. And all creation except us does this. We, on the other hand, taught ourselves to fear a ferocious masculine God, and then we forgot a generous, giving and balancing goddess, and the God did not play ball, didn't work, so we gave him up entirely and became the gods ourselves. So we have to try and let go of control. This is almost impossible in our current culture, but we have to give it a go. And the good thing is the little that we do counts hugely. The divine feminine probably is COVID-19. The divine feminine is trying to decimate humanity. She's trying to take our numbers down to save the planet. And we won't let her. Now, I'm not saying we should go for herd immunity. I'm not saying the lockdowns are wrong or anything. I live in this culture. I want to live. I want my elderly mother to live. I want my sister-in-law who's still recovering from cancer to live. I would be deeply unhappy with the idea of let it come. But that is the ultimate left-hand column of the divine feminine, of how to put the matter straight. So what are we doing instead? We are peddling harder. We're making plastic. We're making non-disposable masks. We're making plastic boundaries. We're wearing PPI. Well, that's the wrong word for it. Sorry, PPI is the money back stuff. You know, all this plastic stuff to protect ourselves. So what we're actually doing is galloping faster and pedaling faster downhill as the divine feminine shows up to say, stop. So, homework. And there's been a lot of stuff for you to take in this week, and we'll be doing a lot more lightweight stuff next week, but it's still very valid stuff. But the start of the work involves reconnecting with the source of all things, the source of grace, and we have to learn how to receive instead of how to get or how to buy or how to push. And the way our receptiveness, as women particularly, though I think men have a little bit of it too, is we have been taught not to receive, we've been taught to give, and that's masculine. We've been taught to do, do, do. And we can tell how we are with the attitude of receptivity when somebody gives us a compliment, because we've been taught to reject it. We've been taught to throw it back and negate it, and to give in return for the compliment. We have absolutely very, very little, well, not absolutely, but very little concept of the thought of just saying thank you. That's the balance, divine feminine. Somebody had the grace and the kindness to give you a compliment. And what do? We go, oh, this old thing. Oh, no, my hair's a mess. Oh, I got it. Only got it at a charity shop. Oh, but you look much better. Oh, it's nothing. It's not my best work. I should have done more. Oh, I added too much salt to it. That's when somebody praises your cooking. Or I didn't add enough salt to it. Or it would have been better with some quince. Or it would have been better if I had some chives. Or, oh, you're just being kind. Or you don't mean that. Or anyone could have done it. Or it wasn't true. Wasn't hard. Or, oh, that's not true. Every time you do that, you are rejecting the Divine Mother. So your first lesson is every compliment you receive, go thank you and shut up. Do not even give back anything, which is information about how you did or got what it was that you have, that they admired. Because if you won't give the compliment, do you know what you're saying? You're telling the other person they have bad taste. You're telling them that they're ill-informed. You're telling them they don't know what they're talking about. You're telling them that they're too easily impressed. And you're telling them that they do not know as much as you do. To refuse a compliment is the height of toxic yang arrogance. Stop it. And your other homework? Your other homework is long-term homework. So I'll give you a little thing to do each week if I can, but there's a lot of long-term stuff, and this is your groundwork for the rest of your life if you want to work with the Divine Feminine, which is to find your holy place, to find a place of power in nature. And there are going to be lots of exercises that you can do from this holy place anytime for the rest of your life. So you are now on a quest to find your holy place. It's got to be somewhere that's relatively enclosed. It's got to be quite close so you don't have to drive for hours to get to it or go on the bus for days. It's got to be a real natural setting. Now, this is difficult if you're in a city, but I found a power place on the Dorlis Walkway in Finchley in London when I lived there. And there's always going to be somewhere. Your garden is not the holy place. It really is important to find somewhere which has got enough rural setting for you to find a little enclave in it. You could probably do it in one of the parks. But if you have any way of getting to a beautiful rural place that's unpopulated by humans and uncultivated, do it. And the most important thing about this is that you must go alone. You do not take even your dog. And you never tell even your loved one where it is. Because your loved one will want to come with you. And this is one of the disciplines of working with the Divine Feminine. Because if you have a holy place and you can visit it, say, once a month, doesn't need more than that. Once a week is marvellous, but once a month, you have to find the discipline to give yourself the time and the space to do this. And our mother culture is totally against that. I don't have time to go out in nature. If I go out in nature, I've got to walk the dog. If I go out in nature, I've got to take the children. If I go out to nature, I've got to go to the shops on the way. Can you see how absolutely insidious this is? And we don't even notice it because it's ingrained in the mother culture of our world. So this is your job for the next 6 weeks. Probably in the next 6 weeks, you'll be able to find a place. A place that's got a bit of shelter might be nice, but you will get to the point where you can go there and sit down for 20 minutes and just be there and watch the seasons and watch the birds and watch the animals. And you will start to see the elementals. It's one of the things we're going to be talking about a bit further down the course. The spirits of nature. Because they are willing to work with us to heal this world. We're going to have a whole session on working with the spirits of nature. Because they're aching for us to go back to what's known as the honourable harvest, which is working in the world and with the world and of the world. So, that is our workshop for the evening. Have we got any questions? We have. We've got 6 questions coming in. I get compliments and I say thank you, but very often they bounce off me. I forget them very quickly. What would you advise? I would advise repeating the words to yourself in your head. Along the lines of, if I say to you, Anne, I think you're fabulous. Go, Maggie thinks I'm fabulous. And then you can just observe your ego, which will resist that. Well, Maggie's a prat, you know. But just observe it and just repeat it to yourself, because repetition is the way that we learn these things. Okay. There's nothing wrong with a charity shop. Absolutely, there's nothing wrong with a charity shop. Recycling is wonderful. And more of us have been using charity shops lately, which is great. Unfortunately, they got shut in the lockdown. I had to buy a new pair of trousers. I was shocked and horrified by the fact that I had to buy a new pair of trousers in lockdown because I couldn't get to a thrift shop or a charity shop. Walter, love comments about the rise of horticulture. It allowed for increased populations. This created population pressures which demanded more intense agriculture, fertilisers, collective farming, etc., allowing for an endless cycle of population pressures and increase, intensive labour leading to industrialisation. this led to the cliff. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. And to be even more harsh, when there's a famine, we send food and we save the people, because that's what good people do. And that's right. But the second we end the famine, that population increases. So we need to grow more food. And then there's another famine. And because we're loving, generous people, we contribute to saving the people, because the people are more important than the planet. And that's the lesson we actually have to learn, that we're not. Because the planet's going to start showing us very, very swiftly that. Sally, I love charity shops and use them all the time. I think about not saying anything at all and being able to receive the compliment. Yes, absolutely. Charity shops are great. Stella, when are we going to be doing healing visualizations? That's such a masculine comment, isn't it? I want more. I want different. We'll be doing them as and when they are appropriate. I'm sorry, that's a terrible answer, but it's a very divine feminine answer, but we will be doing.
It's just, I saw a great benefit for the divine feminine about
it. Absolutely, and we will be doing them. We will be doing quite a lot of visualization. Do not worry, we'll be going to meet her for a start.
Yes, absolutely.
That might be quite scary. I agree with your comments about veganism, but only once meat is not produced on an industrial level is there too much animal suffering. Yes, absolutely. But there's too much industrial and horrible stuff going on because of our population. It's all about our population. And you cannot say to the world, you can't have more children. But the more children we have, the more we've got to produce food. And the more children we have, the more we are pedaling down that cliff. And we've got to start backpedaling pretty darn soon. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me. I'm now going to stop the recording and see you all next week. Bless you.